From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the great country music singer and songwriter Merle Haggard. Before he became a musician, he lived the kind of life that's often mythologized in song, hopping freights and doing time in prison. Last year, Haggard was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. We featured a brief excerpt of this interview. Today we'll hear a complete version. Also, we remember Mickey Mantle with an excerpt of a 1985 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. There are already damage reports out of Bermuda from Hurricane Felix. The storm, with its 85-mile-an-hour winds, is about 80 miles from the island chain. Commercial air traffic has been canceled, and forecasters predict the worst is yet to come. Felix has also caused problems for the east coast of the United States, creating dangerous riptides miles off the North Carolina coast. Eileen LeBlanc of member station WHQR reports.
The National Weather Service in Wilmington has warned beachgoers to stay out of the water off North Carolina. 6-foot swells are causing rip currents, which can pull a swimmer swiftly offshore. Yesterday, 99-degree temperatures sent many on the beach into the Atlantic, ignoring the warnings of the lifeguards, prompting over 200 water rescues. One 18-year-old man at Fort Fisher drowned after he swam out to warn children of the dangers and was caught in a current. Another is in critical condition after being pulled from the currents by lifeguards, and a third man is still missing. Dangerous conditions are expected to continue through Wednesday unless Felix turns away or dies out. For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Wilmington, North Carolina.
A man who owes more than $500,000 in child support payments is back in jail today. Jeffrey Nichols was formally charged with crossing state lines to evade child support payments. Nichols is accused of trying to hide his money and himself in 3 states and 2 foreign countries. He is denied fathering the daughter and 2 sons born during his 16 years with his wife. For the first time in its history, a female cadet took part in Hell Week at the Citadel Military Academy. Shannon Faulkner reportedly was the first out of her barracks this morning to begin training at the South Carolina school. Cadet Captain Brian Skipper says he thinks Faulkner can make it at the Citadel if she remains focused.
Basically, it'll be up to her as far as her inner strength and determination. Right now, lots going through their minds as they're getting instructed, learning a lot of new things as far as the military stuff. So basically, if she's determined in things, I think she'll do all right.
Although she has fought for 2.5 years to join the all-male corps of cadets and has attended classes at the Citadel for 20 months, today was Faulkner's first day of cadet training. Attorneys for O.J. Simpson said today they would fight an effort to take jurors back to the scene of the double murder. Judge Lance Ito said he joined defense and prosecution attorneys last night to determine whether it would be appropriate for the jurors to view the site at night. Also today, prosecutors say they've obtained copies of a taped interview of Detective Mark Furman made by a North Carolina scriptwriter. The defense refused to turn over its copies to prosecutors last week. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 39.1 points at 4657.4 in moderate trading of 250 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. A group of Native Americans from a Navajo tribe continue to occupy the Rainbow Bridge National Monument in Utah. The group considers the sandstone natural bridge sacred. The National Park Service has closed the area to tourists. From Salt Lake City, Howard Berkus reports.
The Navajo occupiers claim Rainbow Bridge has been defiled and desecrated during 25 years of National Park Service management. Navajos believe the arch sandstone bridge is a rainbow turned to stone. The site is sacred to 5 Southwest tribes. 1,000 tourists a day visit the bridge, paying up to $80 a person. They're brought in by tour boats using the waters of Lake Powell to reach the remote area near the Utah-Arizona border. The protesters have blocked access to the bridge since Friday. They've been conducting cleansing ceremonies and say they'll leave by tomorrow. A Park Service spokeswoman says the group's claims are unfounded, noting negotiations with area tribes resulted in a ban on walking up to or under the bridge. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
The first boatloads of Croats crossed the Sava River into Croatia today as Serbs began the completion of a 3-year ethnic cleansing of their stronghold. Hundreds of people are expected before nightfall, and thousands are likely to follow. In Sarajevo, United Nations officials say the Croatian government is willing in principle to receive all Croat families from the region who wish to go to Croatia. Meanwhile, Croatian troops and Bosnian Serbs continue heavy fighting around the city of Dubrovnik along the Adriatic coast. British authorities said today they have redoubled their efforts to gain the release of 4 Westerners still held hostage by Kashmiri separatists. The statement follows news yesterday that the militants killed and beheaded Norwegian captive Christian Ostro. Al-Faran terrorists say they killed Ostro because the Indian government had not complied with its demands to release 15 separatist comrades held in jail. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Merle Haggard. Music critic Peter Guralnick has said about him, "There is no one in contemporary popular music who has created a more impressive legacy or one that spans a wider variety of styles." A new batch of CDs has made it easy to hear that wide range of styles. A 2-disc retrospective called The Lonesome Fugitive features some of Haggard's best-known songs, including Mama Tried, The Bottle Let Me Down, and Okie from Muskogee. 2 reissues feature Haggard paying tribute to Jimmy Rogers and Bob Wills. And 2 recent albums pay tribute to Merle Haggard. Tulare Dust features singer-songwriters performing Haggard songs. And on Mama's Hungry Eyes, his songs are sung by country music stars. Last year, Haggard was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. Last spring, we featured a short excerpt of this interview with Merle Haggard. Before we hear the complete version, let's listen to Haggard's 1969 recording of the Jimmy Rogers song, Waiting for a Train, from the reissue, Same Train, a Different Time.
All around the water tanks, waiting for a train, 1,000 miles away from home, sleeping in the rain. I walked up to a brakeman to give him my talk. He says, if you've got money, I'll see that you don't walk. I haven't got a nickel, not a penny can I show. Get off your railroad bum, and he slammed that boxcar door.
Merle Haggard, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm really glad this album has been reissued. It's really wonderful. I'd love to hear you talk about how you discovered the music of Jimmy Rogers and what his music meant to you when you were young.
Well, I was experimenting with the guitar and trying to learn to sing and play it. I must have been about 12, and one of my idols at the time was a guy named Lefty Frizzell, and he had a new record out, and I was making issue of it with my mother, and she said, "Well, that's not a new song. That's a Jimmy Rogers song." And I said, "Well, who is Jimmy Rogers?" And she explained, and I actually went and brought what we called an album in those days, which was like 4 78 records containing 8 songs. And on those 8, I think there was Waiting for a Train, there was California Blues, and there was, I remember My Old Pal, and My Carolina Sunshine Girl. Anyway, I found out that Jimmy Rogers was the beginner, or the, as some people like to call him, the father of what we call country music today. That was my first experience with Jimmy.
Now, I picked Waiting for a Train in part because I think you really love trains, and I know you've spent a lot of time on them. Did you hop freights when you were young?
Yeah, sure did.
Where would you go?
Well, I lived in an oil community called Oildale, there was a daily train that went into the oil fields, and it was a steam train back in those days, and I actually grew up every evening, you know, kind of looking forward to seeing that old train pull out of there with about 40 or 50 oil tankers back during the war, you know, it was less than a stone's, well, maybe 150 feet from my back door to where the railroad track ran, and I actually grew up right next to it. My dad worked for the Santa Fe Railroad, and he only lived, I was 9 when he passed away, but railroads were, you know, very influential in my life, and there was enough of it in the songs that I admired to get me on the freight myself. I thought, well, this is something I got to do. If they're going to write songs about it, I got to go see why. So I did, and I rode freights wherever they took me. I rode them for a block, or I'd ride them 200 miles, or I think the longest trip I ever took was from San Antonio to El Paso, I think was the longest one.
Was it hard to learn how to hop a freight?
No, I learned that probably the first time I ever jumped on that old oil tanker was probably, I was about 5 years old. My mother would have died if she had known I'd been up there. We used to put pennies on the track, you know, and we'd hop that old train, ride a block or two, and jump off. So it was something we learned to do young. We'd watch the brakemen and the trainmen do it. You know, it wasn't really all that hard.
What's the worst or the most surprising experience that you had on a freight train?
The worst? There was a lot of bad experiences. I got on a freight in Oregon one time, and it was leaving out of Eugene, and it went up into the Cascades and into a snowstorm, and I was traveling in the ice compartment, and me and two other oboes was in there, and it got rather cold in that metal, and I remember they stopped up in the mountains and climbed up out of that ice compartment, and I'm shaking so bad that I dropped my suitcase off the top of the freight and I had to get off for a while to get her up my clothes.
Just sounds awful. Did you have frostbite?
Somehow or another, somebody watched out for me. I didn't get anything like that.
Were there ever traveling musicians on the trains, and did you feel you learned anything about a musician's life?
I didn't run into any players on the freight. Just people traveling, and for different reasons, I'm sure. I don't know. Most of them probably for the same reasons. I think they were probably hobos, you know. I remember one time I stole a can of beans out of a refrigerator car and threw it up into this boxcar where all the rest of the hobos were riding. And, boy, they got really upset. They said, oh, we're going to get 50 years in the penitentiary, you know. You must be a really green guy, you know, and there was nobody would share that box of green beans except one old man, and he was about 80 years old, and he threw a spoon and a can opener across the boxcar to me and said, I'll help you eat them, son.
Merle Haggard is my guest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Oh, Lord. Uh-huh. Yeah. Hey. Oh, big one now.
Merle Haggard is my guest. Now, there's a new CD collection that brings together your recordings from 1963 to 1977. It's called The Lonesome Fugitive. And why don't I play one of the songs featured on there that you wrote? This was first recorded by you in 1968. It's Mama Tried.
The
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried. Mama tried, mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close, at least. There's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So right. Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was, to say the least, probably probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it, actually. I was really kind of a screw-up. And I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home?
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and then the next time I went back, it was for something serious, and then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times from different institutions in California. And all it was just a matter of the authorities running me off. And, you know, they drumming up business for themselves. I really feel sorry for the way they do some of the kids, you know. And I was one of those kids. I'm going to snitch on them if I get a chance.
How would you escape from reform school and youth institutions?
Well, there was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just I think Willie Sutton was my idol. If you don't know, you know, at the time I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
No, was there an outlaw mystique that you wanted to have?
I guess. I don't know. I admired people like Jesse James, you know, along with a lot of other kids, but I guess I took it too far, you know.
So what was your most ingenious escape?
Probably the one that was the most ingenious was one that I didn't actually go on. I was San Quentin. I was all set to go with the only completely successful escape out of San Quentin, I think, in 21 years. But the people that gave me the chance to go were the same people that talked me out of it, because they felt like that I was just doing it for the sport of it, and then it was a very serious thing to the other fellow that was going, and they had a big judge's chamber sort of desk that they were building at the furniture factory in San Quentin, and I had a friend who was building a place for two guys to be transported out. That was before they had x-rays and things of that nature, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, and And the guy that I went with wound up being executed in the gas chamber. He went out and held court in the street, killed a highway patrolman. And so it was really good that I didn't go.
Was that a real sobering experience for you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those things in my life. And, you know, those are the sort of things that that a guy unknowingly like myself, I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just, I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more, and I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never did go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged, and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
What'd you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
But it was just obvious. No, you know, there was no. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and you know, it's hard to be 18 years old, and you know, they send 18-year-old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them, and I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's where the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
You were on death row?
Yeah, I was. I got caught for making beer. Making some beer up there, and I got too much of my own beer and got drunk in the yard and got arrested. And it's hard to get arrested in San Quentin, but I did. And they sent me to what was known as the Shelf, and the Shelf is a part of the North Block, which you share with the inmates on death row. And it's kind of like the there's not too many more stops for you, actually, you know. And that was the, as you put it, sobering experience for me. I wound up with nothing to lay on except a Bible and an old concrete slab, and woke up from that drunk that I'd been on that day, and I could hear some prisoners talking in the area next to me. In other words, there was a alleyway between the back of the cells, and I could hear people talking over there, and I recognized the guy as being Carol Chessman, a guy that they were fixing to execute. And I don't know, it was just something about the whole situation that I knew that if I ever got out of there, if I was lucky enough to get out, I made up my mind, well, I still had that hangover, that I was all finished.
How were you lucky enough to get out?
Well, I went back down on the yard and went down and asked for the roughest job in the penitentiary, which was a textile mill, and went down and just started building my reputation, you know, just started running in reverse from what I'd been doing and started trying to build up a long line of good things to be proud of, and that's what I've been doing since then.
Merle Haggard is my guest, and there's a couple of reissues out now. One's called The Lonesome Fugitive, and it collects his recordings from 1963 to 1977. And there's also a reissue of an album he recorded back in the late 60s featuring the songs of Jimmy Rogers. Back in the days when you were in prison, was music a big part of your life then? Were you singing, playing, writing songs?
Yeah. Yeah, I was already into doing that. I really didn't, I don't think, believe that I sincerely had a future in it. I think I was just kind of like doing what I thought was probably a waste of time or a hobby at the very most, and maybe some extra money on the weekend sort of thing. But that's when I was in San Quentin. I still didn't really thoroughly realize that I had to do this the rest of my life and that it was going to be this successful for me and I was going to, you know, have all the things happen that have happened. I had no idea that you could never have convinced me of a minute amount of the success I've had. I would never have believed it.
Did your musical ability have anything to do with people noticing you in prison and thinking that you could make it when you got out? I mean, did that help you at all in the war?
Yeah, that was the basic reason, I think, that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, just some pretty nice people. And very unfortunate people, and they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it. I finally made a successful escape, you might say.
Merle Haggard will continue the interview in the second part of our show. Let's listen to his song, The Bottle Let Me Down, which is featured on his recent CD collection, The Lonesome Fugitive. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Each night I leave the bar room when it's so time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight the bottle let me down. Come around. The one true friend I thought I'd found. Tonight the bottle let me down. Day. But the wine don't take effect the way it used to. And I'm hurting in an old familiar way. Tonight the bottle let me down.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing the songs of the Lonesome Fugitive. We continue our interview with country music singer and songwriter Merle Haggard. And we remember Mickey Mantle with an excerpt of a 1985 interview.
For years I've been busting my rear to make a living, but it ain't made. For
years I've been... From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Hurricane Felix has lost some of its strength as it pushes toward the Bermuda coast. The storm's winds now average about 85 miles an hour, but Bill Frederick of the National Hurricane Center in Miami says Felix can still cause a great deal of damage.
Felix is a Category 1 storm, but its main threat is it's a large storm. The hurricane force winds are extending outward up to 115 miles from the center, so this is a very large storm, so they're going to be experiencing the hurricane force winds and the strong tropical storm force winds for a prolonged period of time.
Residents of the east coast of the United States are being warned to keep an eye on Felix. High winds have already created rough seas, which have led to at least one drowning in North Carolina. Medical experts suggested today that the Pentagon is not justified in saying there was no evidence of disorder known as Gulf War Syndrome. An Institute of Medicine reports that the Department of Defense made a conscientious effort to evaluate the health of the veterans who complained of an unusual illness after the Persian Gulf War. But the Institute said the Pentagon failed to support its conclusion that there was no such thing as Persian Gulf Syndrome among the troops. A former employee for Archer Daniels Midland, who acted as a government informant, reportedly attempted suicide last week. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Wall Street Journal says Mark Whitaker, who blew the whistle on Archer Daniels Midland for alleged price-fixing, tried to commit suicide at his home in Decatur, Illinois. Whitaker had been working with the Justice Department in their probe of ADM. According to a senior executive at Archer Daniels, Whitaker was fired after he allegedly stole more than $5 million from the company. The Journal report says the company has accused Whitaker of stealing at least $2.5 million through forging checks and transferring money to a Swiss company he controlled. The paper says Whitaker sent a letter to the Wall Street Journal before his attempted suicide that apparently referred to the money he is accused of stealing. The Journal quotes the letter as reading, "Regarding overseas payments to some employees, dig deep, it's there. They give it, then use it against you when you are the enemy." Whitaker had reportedly been scheduled to meet with federal authorities on the morning of his suicide attempt. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Mexican Government Human Rights Commission today accused authorities in the southern state of Guerrero of having indiscriminately gunned down and killed 17 leftist peasants in June. The commission accused the state government of trying to cover up evidence of criminal police action and called for the dismissal and investigation of senior state officials. Kmart Corporation reported today a $54 million loss for the second quarter of this year. The retailer was hurt by heavy discounting on its merchandise. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 41.56 to close at 4659.86, advances ahead of declines 4-3 on volume of 262 million shares. You're listening to NPR News. Security remains tight at New York's three main airports today because of a threat of a terrorist attack by Middle Eastern militants. Security at Kennedy International was raised to the highest level since the Gulf War in 1991. We get details from UPI's Bill Riley.
Passengers at Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark airports are being advised to leave time to spare, time to park perhaps in distant spaces, and undergo vehicle security checks. Time to check baggage and to allow for questioning about your luggage and if you are the one who did the packing and has your luggage been in your possession since you packed. There is no curbside check-in. Only ticketed passengers are allowed in gate areas, and ticketed passengers are the only people allowed into the International Arrivals Building at Kennedy Airport. Bill Riley, New York.
The environmental group Greenpeace said today it would send a ship to the Turkish port city of Izmir to call attention to the pollution off the Aegean coast. Izmir Bay is considered by some environmentalists to be one of the most polluted in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Greenpeace says it also hopes to rally support against upcoming French and Chinese nuclear testing. Libya's President Muammar Gaddafi today accused Jordan of helping the United States in a terrorism policy against Arabs. Gaddafi was reacting to news of top-level Iraqi defections last week. Without naming King Hussein, who granted asylum to the defectors, Gaddafi added that any Arab leader who encourages America is really doing this job to earn a living. The government today reported the smallest monthly jump in business inventories in 15 months. The Commerce Department said that inventories edged up just 0.2% in June. The small increase had been expected. Analysts say businesses have kept their stockpiles at lower levels because of poor sales earlier in the year. Large backlogs could lead to cuts in production and lost jobs. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with singer and songwriter Merle Haggard. Last year, he was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. A recent double CD collects many of his best-known songs. Two recent CDs pay tribute to him.
Tell us the story how you got your first guitar.
My first guitar?
Yeah. Or how you started to play guitar.
Well,
as it was.
I have an older brother named Lowell, and Lowell had a service station at the time, and there was a guy who came in and wanted a couple of dollars worth of gas and didn't have no money, and he left a little Bronson, sort of a Stella Sears and Roebuck type guitar, and as collateral, and he never did come back after it, and that old guitar sat in the closet there for a couple of years, and finally, I think my mother showed me a couple of chords. My brother didn't know how to play, and my dad had passed away. He was a musician in the family, so Mama showed me C chord that Daddy had showed her, and she didn't know how to make C chord very good. But I took it from that, and I beat around on that old Bronson. I think it was a Bronson guitar.
I imagine when you first got the guitar, you were playing the songs that you heard on the radio. How did you start writing songs yourself?
Well, about the same time that I discovered Jimmy Rogers, I was about 12 years old, I discovered Hank Williams. And I remember seeing on the yellow MGM records there was the artist's name, and then there was another name underneath that artist. It was a small, very small letters, and it said composer. And I didn't know what a composer was. I asked my mother, I said, what does this mean? She said, I don't know. And she called the record store, and they told her, that's the writer. That's the guy that writes the songs. And it seemed to me that it was very important to have your name in both places there. I noticed that Hank Williams had a little extra clout because he wrote his own songs. Jimmy Rogers, the same thing, you know. And so I felt it was just as necessary to become a songwriter as it was to try to learn to play the guitar. It was certainly a tool that most people, I think, in the business would like to be a singer-songwriter if they could be, because it is in some way your retirement. You know, you can have a great career, and if you don't write songs or have a publishing company or something to lean back on when it's all over, it's a pretty hard drop back to reality, you know. And once you've learned to live under the conditions I've learned to live on, you better have yourself a publishing company or I'll have to go back to being an outlaw.
When you started writing songs, did you realize that you could write autobiographical songs from your own life, or did you think you had to copy other people's songs?
Well, I really didn't realize what method to take at first. I must have wrote maybe 1,500 songs that weren't any good, or at least I never kept them, and finally with a lot of help and a lot of people who had written hit songs who I'd become friends with, such as Fuzzy Owen, who became my personal manager. It was a songwriter, and he helped me. He taught me how to write songs, and finally I wrote one that was worth keeping, and I think I've written about 300 keepers or so, maybe 400.
Do you remember the first one that you felt this is worth keeping?
Yeah, it was a sort of a rock and roll song. Elvis-type rock and roll thing. It was called If You Want to Be My Woman. And Glenn Campbell opened his shows with it for years, and I still do the song. And I wrote it when I was about 14. But I didn't keep very many. That was probably one out of that 1,500 that got kept.
Could you sing a couple of bars of it?
You like riding in the country in my Cadillac, and you keep, I keep pushing me back, something back. On the money that I earned, but you refused to give me something equal in return. Don't look at me like maybe you don't understand. If you want to be my woman, you know you got to let me be your man.
And how old were you when you wrote
something
it?
Like that.
How old were you?
14.
Wow. So this is just about the time that you started that whole round of reform schools.
Yeah, I might have been as much as 15 or 16 when I wrote that song. It was between 14 and 17, I'm not sure.
Merle Haggard is my guest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Merle Haggard. Now, during all the years that you were in and out of prisons and reform schools, did you ever think I can make a living with music?
No, I counted on extra money, as I was saying, you know, like, you know, maybe a hobby. I figured I was going to have to have some other means of employment, you know, or support.
So what made you think, well, I can make a living out of this?
Well, when I came out of the penitentiary, I went to work for my brother digging ditches and wiring houses. He had an electrical company, Hag Electric. And he was paying me $80 a week. This was 1960. And I was working 8 hours a day there. And I got me a little gig playing guitar 4 nights a week for $10 a night. And there was a little radio show that we had to broadcast from this little nightclub called High Pockets. And it just all started from that. Some people that had, that was local stars around heard me on this radio program and came down and offered me a better job in town, and it wasn't just a matter of weeks till I was part of the main clique in Bakersfield. And it was hard to get in that clique. There was a lot of people like Buck Owens, and there was people that were really good and proved how good they were later on with their success. And Bakersfield was some sort of it was like country music artists found their way to Bakersfield and had the success out of there. I don't understand why, actually. It may be because of the migration that took place in the 30s or whatever. There was a lot of people that came out there from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas that had a lot of soul. This thing we call country music kind of came out of those honky-tonks, you know, and some of the same area that a lot of other things came out of.
Was it hard for you to adjust to success and stardom, having come from poverty and, you know, having lived in prison off and on for so many years? I think it's hard for a lot of people to adjust to that.
Well, a lot of people may or may not understand how hard it is for a person coming out of an institution, you know, whether it be a prison or whether it be some sort of a mental institution, whether it be the army or whatever. There's a there's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine and a a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there and you're next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left, and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back, and it's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
There's a new CD in which singer-songwriters pay tribute to your songs by performing them. The CD is called Tulare Dust. And I'd like you to choose one of your favorite tracks from this CD, and then we'll play it.
Okay, I have several on there, but they're all, you know, I'm glad that they all did it. But I like Iris DeMent's version of Big City better than I do my own.
Why?
I don't know. It's really strange to hear somebody sing your song and get meaning out of the words you wrote that you didn't realize was there. And I went and purchased a couple of albums that she had out, and I haven't been able to get away from her. I've been listening to her for 3 months, and she's just blowing me away. She's the best singer I ever heard.
Merle Haggard. His recent CD retrospective is called The Lonesome Fugitive. Let's hear the recording we were just talking about from the Merle Haggard tribute album, Tulare Dust. This is Iris DeMent singing Haggard's song, Big City.
Off my steady job today. So turn me loose, set me free. Somewhere in the middle of Montana. And give me all I've got coming to me. And keep your retirement and your so-called Social Security. Big city, turn me loose, set me free.
Iris DeMent singing Merle Haggard. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll be talking with NPR's Sylvia Pajoli in Kosovo, a province of Serbia, about Serb refugees from the Krajina region who've been sent now to Kosovo, complicating things there for the majority ethnic Albanian population. NPR's Eric Weiner reports that Kashmiri separatists have now threatened to kill another Western hostage tomorrow. NPR's Peter Overby reports from Capitol Hill on the lack of progress of campaign reform legislation. Linda Wertheimer talks with the woman and the man who say they indeed were the kissing couple in the famous Times Square photograph celebrating VJ Day 50 years ago.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We end today's show by remembering Mickey Mantle. He died Sunday of cancer, which ravaged his body shortly after a liver transplant briefly saved him. He was 63. I spoke with Mantle in 1985, after the publication of his autobiography, The Mick. Mantle had one of the most illustrious careers in the history of baseball, but he often played in pain because of knee and foot injuries. I asked him if it was typical for baseball players to be in that much pain.
It was out of the ordinary, really, and I think probably exaggerated a little bit all the pain that I played in. I did I had to wrap my leg with about a 10-foot bandage. It was like a gauze on one side and rubber on the outside, and I would tape it from like my hip all the way down to my ankle, both of my legs, because I hurt the other leg too after that. And it looked like it was worse than it was. I looked like a mummy when I was getting ready to play, and I got a lot of press where they said, poor Mickey, you know, he can't do this, he can't do that. But I wasn't hurting as bad as they thought I was, probably.
When it became clear that you were going to be a great home run hitter, would you always go for the home run when you were up at bat?
Well, I went for the home run every time I swung at a ball. I was trying to hit it as far as I could. That wasn't just when I became a home runner. I was always a home run hitter from the time I was a kid. So that's all I like. I love to see how far I could hit a ball.
When you thought you had a home run, would you stand there and
no.
watch it, or would you just start running just in case?
The Reggie trot, I didn't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you
no.
didn't do that.
In fact, I never tipped my hat or did the high five or anything like that. It always embarrassed me, really, to see the opposing pitcher. I hated to look at the opposing pitcher because I knew how he must feel, because I knew how I felt when he struck me out. You know, he didn't jump up and down and wave his hands and tip his hat when he struck me out. So why should I do all that when I hit a home run off of him?
It was in 1961, I think, that you and Roger Maris were both trying to break the Babe Ruth record of 60 home runs in one season. How important was it for you to try to break that record?
Well, anybody that ever played baseball, especially a home run hitter, would love to break that record, 61 homers. I tried it once before in 1956. I hit 52 homers. And going into September, I was way ahead of Babe Ruth's home run record. It looked like I might do it that year. And then Roger came along in 61, and me and him both was way ahead of Babe Ruth's record going into the last month. I got sick. I had a real bad cold, and I took a shot from some quack doctor in New York somebody sent me to. And I had to have my hip lanced, and I missed the last couple of weeks. But Roger went ahead and broke it. And I think probably that's the greatest single feat I've ever seen in pro sports, was Roger hitting them home runs, because I know how hard it is to do. The public is not only the public, but the press and everybody else is following you everywhere you go. And Roger is not an outgoing guy. He was, he's really backward. He don't like a lot of press or anything like that. So I realized what a thing it was for him to do, to break that record. And like, I wasn't there the last couple of weeks, but he had big splotches of hair coming out from his nerves, you know. So it was really hard for him to do it. And there should never be an asterisk by his record in the record book. He did something that I think was really hard to do.
The fans really rooted for him to break the record, but you say that once it was broken, they turned against him, and then they started giving you ovations. Can you explain the psychology that you think was motivating
the fans? I think probably
the
American public is always for the underdog, and they wanted me to break the record. If somebody was going to break Babe Ruth's record, they wanted it to be me. Because I'd been there for all this long, you know, for a long time. Roger just came up, and the American public's like for the underdog all the time, and I was the underdog in that race. And when Roger finally did break the record, everybody started, up until that time, I'd been like the villain. You know, I'd taken trying to take Joe DiMaggio's place and everything, and they'd been booing me all that time. And all of a sudden, Roger wins the home run contest. He hit 61 homers. They turned their wrath on Roger instead of me. And everywhere I went from then on, I was like the hero and Roger was the villain. So it really did help me a lot.
Did you learn to distrust fans because they were so fickle?
No, I learned right away that you can be a bum one day and a hero the next day. So you got to take them both. You know, if you strike out four times and they boo you, you got it coming. You know, but the next day you hit a home run with the bases loaded or get a single in the ninth inning and drive in the winning run, they forget about the four strikeouts. So I learned that early in life.
What did you think of your hero status in America? I mean, you were a symbol for, you know, just about every person, especially boys growing up in New York, and then across the whole nation. You were a symbol too. You were an American hero. You stood for baseball. You stood for, you know, what was good about the country. Was that a lot to live up to? Did it feel like you?
Well, yeah, you have to, you have to really watch yourself. I felt like I did anyway, and the Yankees always, you know, like I I used to like to chew tobacco, and they made me quit chewing, or they asked me, they couldn't make you not do it, but they asked me, don't chew tobacco because, you know, it don't look like a Yankee, and the kids now, they look do look up to you. If I was drinking, I would try to stay out of sight. You know, I never did smoke because I was afraid. I did do a Camel commercial one time, and I always wished I hadn't have because my dad didn't like for me to do commercials like that. I don't think he would have liked for me to do a beer commercial. I did one of those. I did a lot of things that I felt bad about later on, but at the time, it didn't seem that important.
Yeah, that same time that you were the national hero, you were really doing a lot of drinking, too, and I think you were famous for your carousing among baseball players.
I'm more famous for it now than I was then. A lot of people are surprised when they read that book because they didn't know I even drank. And if when you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic, but that's the farthest thing from the truth. It's just that the fun that I did have through my baseball career was when I was drinking. I mean, I guess my personality came in a bottle, for as I know, because the stories that I tell in that book are probably 15 or 20 things that happened over 18 years. And if you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic. And that's another. If there is a moral to that book, it would be for little league kids or kids in high school or college, anybody, in fact, to take better care of their bodies, because guys like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial. All the guys that are really good and that are their names are at the top of the list in the lifetime statistics are guys that took good care of themselves and played 20 years. I was over the hill at 34 and had to retire at 36, and it's probably because I didn't take as good a care of myself as I should have.
Mickey Mantle, recorded in 1985 after the publication of his autobiography, The Mick. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.